I am from beyond. Listen, and all you desire will be yours. Welcome to Spider-Dan and the Secret Wars. Prepare for battle.
Welcome to Prattle World. I'm your host, the ever-amazing, ever-spectacular Spider-Dan, and in this podcast, I spotlight entertainment's best-kept secrets that a mainstream audience may find boring. Welcome back, guys. Welcome to the second ever edition of Secret Defenders, where I invite guests in to defend some of their favourite films that people either don't like so much, or kind of have a cult fan base, or generally people have never heard of. So in this episode, we are going to ask the question, what lurks in the... What is it? What is it? How's the line go? I forget.
What evil lurks in the hearts of men?
Say that again, sir. Say that again.
It's what evil lurks in the hearts of men.
And Dan Kietis knows. Welcome, Dan.
The shadow knows.
The shadow knows. So we're going to look at the shadow. So how are you doing, Dan?
I'm good. How have you been feeding your fan of the... Oh, shit. No, wrong podcast. Force of habit. Well, no, I'm delighted to be here with you on Prattle World. It's good. I don't understand why you're making me wear this thong and smearing me with Marmite, but I'm assuming it's all part of some ancient ritual that... Yeah. No, it's good. It's good to be part of the...
It's an ancient, you know, Chinese Mongolian ritual.
Oh, okay.
So I can absorb the power of Genghis Khan for my further my world domination.
That's absolutely fine. That's absolutely fine.
So some people might recognize your voice from...
Yes, we were on the Nerdify podcast together with our friend Josh Bison and occasionally Violet. And we had a good run.
We did.
It just became a combination of sort of not having enough time to give it the time, care, and attention that it needed, and also just sort of like the expense was getting on top of me a bit. This is all going to come full circle, so I'm going to mention it later. But we got to a point where Justice League had just come out, and it was a very kind of divisive, very sort of toxic time in fandom.
And even Last Jedi to an extent.
And Last Jedi, yeah, it was a bit of a double whammy of divisiveness, and it sort of wasn't doing my sort of well-being any favors. So we kind of called it a day for a variety of reasons, but it's really nice actually to be casting pods again.
I'm so glad that you could come. Like, I wanted you on earlier, but obviously you're ill and stuff, so we couldn't do that.
I apologize for that, but it's great to hear other people doing the secret defending. So
definitely, and I've got I think I'm doing another one with another guest a little later this weekend, I think, so that'd be great. But let's crack on, shall we?
So
that's basically, we know each other because we met on an acting job.
Yes.
Some of the best and worst acting we've probably ever done in our life on that particular, with that particular company.
Yeah, I agreed wholeheartedly. Yeah.
There's a few large shadows cast from that company and from that work. That's how we met we all met Josh as well. So we know each other for quite a long
time.
But
it's formed lifelong friendships in the same way that a war or a sexual assault does.
Yes. Post-traumatic stress. There was a lot of that afterwards. I still talk about it now. All the acting horror stories mostly come from that tour.
Yeah.
But the thing that made me keep doing it, the thing that, you know, strengthened my resolve to keep going was you guys being there and enduring it with me.
The amount of actors I talked to after that, those tours, who were like, get the fuck out, you're making this up.
But it really happened. We won't go to again, this is not a podcast for that, so let's get started on the film. So The Shadow was
thank you for reining me in.
Don't worry. So The Shadow was released, was it 94?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So it's between the Tim Burton Batman films and the Joel Schumacher Batman film. And it's kind of, in a lot of ways, embodies the sort of the midway point in that tonal shift, because there is a lot of the sort of the dark and broody stuff.
Oh, definitely.
But there's also a healthy dose of camp, which I think was an homage to sort of like the inherent campiness of a radio series, you know, where everyone's describing what they're doing and what they're thinking, because you don't have any room for subtext on the radio.
There is no subtext. No subtext here either. The Shadow is kind of historically was a pulp figure, wasn't he?
It was, yeah. One of the first kind of, I'm thinking there's Sherlock Holmes and Dracula, but it was an early sort of multimedia phenomenon. He started out in the pulps and then very quickly sort of went to the radio. And in the same way that a lot of Superman's mythology was defined by the radio show and later the Fleischer cartoons, a lot of the Shadow's mythology, as we were discussing before we started rolling, was determined by his the canon of the radio serials. But He's a hard character to lock down in terms of, so he doesn't have one discrete mythology. Lots of different. It's very, very different. Obviously, these pulps were printed at a time when they were just sort of disposable.
Yeah. Comic books as well, very disposable. There was no real continuity back then.
Exactly, yeah. No one was thinking, well, what's the plan here? Which is why, obviously, Stan Lee, God bless him, was such an amazing, so ahead of his time, because he had a plan for it all and how it was all interconnected and the world is better for it, especially in the world of comics. But sorry, I digress. But yeah, that's where his roots are.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's it's really important, because I feel that the pulp characters were definitely a precursor to these comic book characters
that
we are enjoying today on the big screen in such kind of grand ways and huge and very continuity heavy as well.
Yes.
But there's a lot of characters back then. There was things like Doc Savage.
Yes.
And all those. And it kind of, the film, before we get into the film, but it does have a very pulpy vibe. It does feel like an Indiana Jones type thing.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah, I've had a very sort of heavy Indiana Jones feel. And that's sort of something that, especially when I think I was 12, 13. No, I was 12 when I first saw it. And yeah, that's something that I really sort of gravitated towards, because it looked and felt like an equal sort of 50% Batman, Tim Burton Batman, and 50% Indiana Jones. And I was here for that.
Yeah, I loved both of those.
But it seems like a lot of my contemporaries weren't, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, like for me, like at the time, I was heavy into all the superhero cartoons at the time that were coming out in the early 90s, X-Men, Spider-Man, Batman especially. And Batman had this very neo, 1930s style to it. It wasn't explicitly set in the 30s, but the architecture and the styles of all the vehicles and, even the Batmobile had a huge grill on it and things like that.
Yeah, very Art Deco.
Yeah, Art Deco. I was there for that, because I was like, this is what I want. It's a Batman, similar Batman character, but maybe that was the problem with the film. Maybe that's why I didn't catch on, because it was too similar to...
I think we talked about like how it would have been received today. And I think in the post-Marvel world, I think people are a lot more receptive to new characters, new larger-than-life sort of characters of this nature. Whereas I think people had much less of a vocabulary for that in 1994. Yes. I mean, there was Batman and there was Superman and there was The Crow, which I think came out about the same time. And that was pretty much it. And I think as a popular consciousness, we are much more... we've got much more of a vocabulary, a much broader palette, that sort of thing. So I think the time is, I think if someone were to have the guts to make a Shadow film now, I think it would have every chance of doing really well. Mm. But then I would have said the same thing about The Spirit, and we all know how that went.
Wow, that was one of my least favorite films of all time. I've never come out of a film like that. I've just started deriding the film and making fun of it second I watched out of the thing.
Yeah, and it was such a shame, because the trailers made it look so promising. Yeah. Well, didn't they? It looked like Sin City 1.5.
Very much a style over substance film for me. I know that Sam Raimi is a big fan of The Shadow and tried to make it a live action, of trying to get the rights for years and years and years, and eventually gave up and decided to make Darkman with Liam Neeson, which is quite a good film in itself.
Very good, It was only in the first one, wasn't he? Wasn't in the other two.
Arnold Vuslow, the guy who plays the mummy.
Yes, because I think that's one of the versions you can have where the character's always wearing a mask.
So he can't
be anyone.
Exactly,
quite like that.
But so let's get back to The Shadow. We're going on all these crazy tangents.
Yeah, no.
This is my infectious,
the
tangent energy.
The part of the fun, really.
Yeah. So you were saying that you saw this when you were 12. Did you go to the cinema?
Yeah.
How did you discover it?
Do you know what? I don't think I saw it at the cinema, but I do remember quite vividly seeing the TV spots for it and thinking, wow, this looks amazing. But growing up in a, I mean, I'm very lucky now because I live in a city centre. So if I want to go to the cinema, I can just go and be there in like 10 minutes.
Freedom.
Yeah, exactly. But when I was a kid growing up in a small town, you know, you had to like get on a bus and have money to go on a bus. And when you don't have that autonomy to do that, like you have to plan going to the cinema quite a lot in advance, and you have to have a parent who's willing to take you. So yeah, I don't think I saw it at the cinema, but I remember thinking they looked really badass. And we didn't even have like Blockbuster or anything like that where I lived, but we did have a library. And I think the first time I saw it was renting it on video from the library. But when I saw it, I was absolutely captivated. And when you're that age, and sort of as well, it was the early 90s, so there wasn't internet fandom as we know it today. So I just assumed, oh, well, I'm looking forward to The Shadow 2. because you just kind of assume, well, that's what happens. Yeah. Superman 1, 2, 3, 4, Batman.
They've set up the sequel.
Yeah, another one on the way. So, you know,
he walks into an alleyway, you know, he's going to do his things.
Yeah, and I remember just being really disappointed when it just kind of, like, it landed with a bit of a whimper, really.
Yeah, I mean, there's other films kind of a similar nature. I know The Phantom came out with Billy Zane and Treat Williams.
Yeah, Catherine that was Zeta. About the same. I think maybe 97 was 96, 97, I could be wrong.
And again, like the Phantom's a very similar type of character. Mm-hmm. But for me, I think the parallels with Batman, again, is its strength.
Yes.
And probably its weakness as well.
Yeah, you do run that risk. I mean, I think one thing I do want to say, and I hope I'm not messing with the order too much, is the production design and the cinematography, they're absolutely gorgeous. And for my money, it looks at least as good, close to as good as Tim Burton Batman.
Yeah, I will heartily agree.
It has the same problem as Batman Returns in that it really, really looks like it's shot on a soundstage. But I kind of like that. And as much as I love the Dark Knight trilogy, which is a lot, it always kind of irked me that Gotham City really, really looked like Chicago or Pittsburgh. You know? It didn't look like the Gotham City I grew up reading in the comics. It wasn't that sort of like caricature of an American city with the gargoyles and the mismatched architecture and stuff. And so I really missed that about the Tim Burton version, and even to a lesser extent, the Joel Schumacher version.
It kind of the imagery and the cinematography for me, like, it conjures up those kind of the heyday of Hollywood, you know, those 1930s films. And the glamour and the glitz and the, you know, when they're going to, I think it's the Cobalt Club they go into. And, you know, you get that sense of, I mean, I'll tell you another film it reminds me of, which I love, and it's very underrated, is The Rocketeer.
Yes,
which is absolutely fantastic, set in the same sort of era, similar era. It's a great kind of pulp, because that was inspired by pulp comics, pulp magazines and pulp stories. So I highly recommend that. If you like The Shadow, if you've seen The Shadow, watch it anyway, because it's great, and The Rocketeer as well. But yeah, they're very in a similar vein.
Oh man, you've made me just really, really want to watch The Rocketeer again. Timothy Dalton was the bad guy in that.
Yeah.
And Jennifer Connelly was in it as well.
Lovely, lovely Jennifer Connelly.
Oh, piss on my
tits. Alan Arkin,
yeah.
And who's the guy? He's the guy in Lost Locke, the guy who plays Locke. He plays Howard Hughes.
Yes.
Yeah,
absolutely. So they're both
in the same vein.
Yeah, very
two film, both very entertaining, very stylized.
And I think both kind of died in the same way. I think it's interesting when you look at the sort of cultural zeitgeist. I think we've got conditioned, especially in a post sort of Captain America, the First Avenger, post Wonder Woman world, we've got quite used to this idea, and certainly in a post Stranger Things world, we've got very used to sort of going back to more, as we go into a very sort of scary present, politically, economically, we become very sort of entranced by this idea of going back in time. Whereas I think in the go-go 90s, everyone was looking forward.
To the millennium.
Yeah. So everything with the Matrix looked further,
exactly.
People wanted to look forward, people wanted futurism, and anything that gave them that, not everything obviously, because you had things like the Lawnmower Man and
love Lawnmower Man,
hackers, and but
not Greg, hackers not so much,
well no, but like things like that, which
very virtual reality, we were very into virtual reality, I think.
Yeah
90s, just the 90s world.
Lawnmower Man, that was another good one.
Yeah,
90s were good to us,
right? I like the 90s. I like the 80s movies as well, like every era, but yeah, that's definitely that the way it's filmed, and like you say, it's on the studio, and you can tell it's on the studio, but the glitz and the glamour is there, and I like that feel. That it, yeah. there's a little bit fake, but there's the realness is underneath.
Heightened is the word I use because when you look at, I mean, even in the acting style, it has that very golden age sort of sense. But and the shot vocabulary has got a very sort of golden age sensibility, and which I think all the cast are kind of leaning into, and I really appreciate that. I mean, if you like put that, turn the color off on your TV, then could quite possibly be a film from 1938.
You know? It could be something like It Happened One Night, or something like, you know, the, you know, all those kind of films, the kind of glitzy glamour.
All the films.
You know, all them films. But yeah, so yeah, it's really good. Should we talk a little bit about the story, the plot, and roughly, if you don't...
I'll do my best. It's quite a difficult one to nail down plot-wise. So
you've bit got... like The Shadow.
Yeah.
Hard exactly, to grasp.
Exactly, yeah. Well, you start off in the opium fields of Tibet in the 1930s with a gang lord by the name of Yinko, who is a white American who has sort of made his fortune in the Oriental sort of crime business, and he's very, very feared and very, very ruthless and savage. And he's visited by a vision of a holy monk, and he is then sort of knocked out, kidnapped, and dragged to the temple of a holy monk called the Tulku, who basically tells him, forces him basically to pursue the path of redemption, and he gives him the ability to sort of psychic abilities, the ability to sort of cloud men's minds, and this makes him invisible. Everything except the one thing he cannot hide, which is his shadow, hence the name The Shadow. And we've then returned to he's gone back to New York, and he's set up this sort of like quasi Batman sort of operation. He's got an underground lair, he's got gadgets, and he's also got a network, like Sherlock Holmes. He's got a network of sort of informants and allies. Every time he saves somebody's life, they become an ally, and they have to wear this little ring which's got a little signal in it with a little nice little kind LED.
Kind of like a Chewbacca thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Solo, he goes, you know, you've saved my life.
Exactly, yeah.
I now own you.
Yeah, they now owe him a life debt, like Jar Jar Binks.
And I do say, again, the Batman parallels are there, but the thing is, like, Bob Kane was inspired by The Shadow to create Batman. So without The Shadow, we don't get that.
Well, especially if you look at those early comics from 1939, you know, where he has an almost sort of vampiric appearance, and he carries a gun for quite a lot of it as well. And I remember
similar guns.
Reading in Bob Kane's autobiography, actually, he says that he met with a lot of controversy for Batman having a gun, and in I think 1940 they sort of like softened his appearance a little bit and made him a bit more wholesome, but he remembers being quite sort of like, well, I don't get it, because the Shadow has a gun, why can't my guy have a gun? But like, it was the post sort of Superman world, and the idea of the notion of what a superhero is was sort of being solidified. So
it was still very much in a state of flux. I don't even think the term was coined at that point anyway, was it?
I don't think it was, no.
It was just a comic book character.
Yeah, I think that came later, maybe in the 40s or 50s.
Yeah, it became like a genre, didn't it? It became a thing. I think, again, like that's the weakness and the strength of The Shadow, is that we know Batman to be is a more popular character, is more identifiable character. The Shadow is a mystery. He's an enigma, and he's supposed to be. I think in those early stories, those early pulp stories, he didn't have like an origin. He was a mysterious figure who had a hard stance on crime, killed criminals.
Yeah.
And you know, he's just a vengeful, evil presence,
and not technically evil,
but evil in regards to what the criminals would
ruthless.
Say. Exactly. It's the troubling thing, but there are similar characters to Batman. There always have been, always will be. There's copycats of Batman, there's a lot of good copycat heroes out there.
Yeah,
you know, you can look at Aquaman or to the Submariner, and you know, all those sort of things. So it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's not necessarily ripping off, because they do become their own thing. I like that he's an evil person. So he's not like Batman. He's like,
I'm okay, you know. I've got some demons, but he's, you know, he's an opium dealer. He's got these women, you know, these kind of harem of women, you know, and he's actively, you see in the first scene, he basically actively kills an innocent man or his friend. And
as we go on, we see him sort of tortured by his memories of who he was, and he's afraid of himself, and he is very much sort of like struggling through this sort of difficult road to redemption. And I really like that. And I think if you're making a film of that now, you'd sort of lean into it a bit more. Going back to like the origin, like what struck me rewatching it, because I haven't seen it for must be about 20 years, but I remember it vividly in the same way that you do when it's a film that you watched a lot as a kid and then just never watch as an adult. But I think that what the film does really well is it tells an origin story with brevity. And it does one thing that you'd never do now, which is you have an opening scene and then it cuts to text.
Yes. I was like, just show me. Give me a montage or something.
He abandoned his ways and went back to New York and blah, 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 blah. Yeah.
That's, they say it's like the den of evil, or some form that the most evil place in the world is New York City.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I don't know how New Yorkers would feel about that.
You'll never find a more wretched hive of scat.
I'd like to talk about the ways that the powers of the shadow are presented in the film, because I think they're done really interestingly and really well, considering the technology at the time.
Yeah, I think a lot of it was optical effects, but there was some CGI in there as well. When the shadow itself, there's a sequence where the camera sort of tracks up a flight of stairs, and it's the shadow. He's invisible, but you see this animated shadow sort of dancing across the walls, and it's very sort of, it's beautifully animated and very, very fluid in a way that you wouldn't be able to do with a live action actor. But then it's sort of like lightning flash, and then it cuts to this beautiful shot of the shadow standing at the top of this very grand staircase with his cape billowing in the wind. And this is before like Batman v Superman, you've got like, it's pretty much always a CGI cape, you know, but they didn't do it. They actually got
even
wires.
Spawn had a CGI cape.
Spawn did have a CGI cape, it wasn't very good. No, like, it wasn't quite a lot of the time.
There was a lot of things wrong with that film. But
I could have very just as easily done that, you know.
Yeah, true.
Have a certain charm.
I would need to see Spawn again. I remember liking the Violator scenes, because I thought it looked amazing. And John Leguizamo was... fun. You know, apart from that, I can't remember much.
I remember the makeup bit and the suit. I really loved the costume. Oh, speaking of costumes, it's worth mentioning, Bob Ringwood was the costume designer of Shadow, and he was also the costume designer of the first Batman. And you really get a sense. I mean, when you look at
linking it to Batman.
It shares a lot of connective tissue, stylistically and thematically, and just in terms of being sort of part of the zeitgeist. You know, it's... there is a lot of connective tissue there, but the costumes are beautiful, the production design is beautiful. It's a really, I looking back at it, I think it just has to be one of those films that was in the wrong place at the wrong time. That's the only reason I can think why people didn't like it.
Because I mean, I think the performances are good. Alec Baldwin, whether you like him or loathe him as a person, I think he's a credible talent.
And I think this is sexy Alan Baldwin as well.
he's got more chest hair than I've ever seen on a man.
He's got more hair in his chest than I have on my head. It's beautiful, thick, glossy, black, jet black chest hair.
Oh, God. And it's kind of the way it kind of curls around his pecs. This is becoming very different podcast.
I want to go to sleep nestled in that chest hair.
But yeah, and he has I think you said, like, nobody has eyes that blue. Nobody.
No. They're astonishing as well. And one thing that I really love about the film is, obviously, the shadows, like, he has that really classic profile with the big Roman nose that's sort of like drooping over the scarf.
Like a Vulcro.
Yeah, exactly. And nobody has that in real life. So what they did was they used prosthetics, but they did it in a very clever way. So he disguises his face with his sort of like psychic trickery. And there's actually a line in the opening scene where he says, the talk crew says to him, you watched your soul and your face change. And I thought it would have been really good if, like, his face looked different in those early scenes where he's the bad guy. I mean, he's got a little bit of stubble and he's got long hair and he's got ratty nails.
So if he had the pronounced nose.
Yeah, I would have liked that. Like, obviously, it's stupid because it's not physically possible. But no. I would have liked if, like, just to symbolise the fact that when he is the shadow, he dips into that sort of dark persona.
Yeah.
Because there's even a line about it in the script.
Yeah.
And I've got to say, speaking of the script, it's a really, really good, really tight, snappy dialogue, really witty.
It is that kind of fast, because in the 30s, all that Humphrey Bogart style dialogue, it was like machine gun fights,
yes,
isn't it?
Yeah,
and you do get a little bit, like, not so much, but there are moments and kind of, you know, the odd kind of duologue where that happens.
There's a lot of trading blows in the dialogue, yeah.
Yeah, and there's Penelope Ann Miller, I think it was.
Yeah.
She does remind me a little bit of those kind of Marilyn Monroe kind of who's the other lady? Fast talker, 30s. Catherine Hepburn? No, no.
I mean, Catherine Hepburn was a little bit later.
Yeah, maybe, no, I'm thinking somebody else, maybe. But yeah,
it's like, hard to take my tongue. Yeah, yeah. Knows out who you mean now.
Please message in if you can remember fast talking women of the 30s.
Not Marilyn Monroe, the other
the
one.
The other famous one. But yeah, so like she has that quality about her and this kind of glitzy. But there's a lot of humour to it. Well, like you were saying, there's a lot of humour, yet there's quite, you know, the dark subject matter we're seeing, like him, you know, flashbacks of him slaughtering people in China.
Yeah, yeah.
But then, you know, these
Tibet.
Yeah,
Tibet.
Sorry.
That's Tibet. Quite an important,
oh,
especially in the...
Oh, God.
That's quite an important prediction.
No offence meant, just a simple slip of the tongue. So the dichotomy is there. And I think that's important because it is quite dark subject matter.
Yeah, yeah.
And him dipping into this darkness, using this dark power for good.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, and that's, again, it's. I see a lot of similarities to Batman Begins. There is a lot to kind of...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They're very similar films.
I think if you made The Shadow now, like the first 20 minutes of the film that we get in 1994, that would have been like an hour and a half and you wouldn't have seen The Shadow till like...
No, and then he would make a...
sweeping
exit. Yeah. I like the you know, when he uses his kind of power to cloud men's minds and women's minds.
Yeah.
They have these contact lenses in, kind of black.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And the way they light the eyes is astonishing.
It's almost like a cat's eye, isn't it? The way there's like a silver point to it, almost like a silver pupil in it. And the lighting kind of just focuses entirely on his eyes. There's like a slit across the eyes and everything else is dark. And obviously, there's the shadow voice.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he puts all this kind of... And it's great. I like Alec Baldwin's performance because he kind of dances between this maniacal, you know, madness that he has, this evil, this darkness, yet there's kind of a humorous, light kind of... I don't know. I don't want to say ticklish, but I don't know what that's the right word.
There's sort of a playful charm.
Yeah, there's a playful charm, and I think honestly, it's one of Alec Baldwin's best performances.
It is a good. It's a genuinely good performance, and it's a performance that works on a lot of levels. And I think Alec Baldwin does have that sort of, and George Clooney has it as well. Mm. That kind of golden age movie star kind of charm, where I mean, he's one of those few people who is, he's both an actor and a movie star.
Definitely,
and you know, even though you don't see so much of him now, when he chooses his roles quite carefully, and he does a lot of comedy as well nowadays. But
I saw a bit of his 30 Rock kind of performance in this. Some of the kind of more witty, because there's a bit where Margot Lane is describing a dream she just had. She's like, I was naked on the beach. She's like, it's very sexually kind of in this little nightgown, like describing, I was naked on the beach and the water was tickling my toes. I was in, you know, and then she was like, what did you dream about? And he's like, I dreamt that I ripped my face off and there was an evil man underneath. And it's kind of like, oh, okay.
And that seems great as well, and just that scene's sort of like fantastic practical effects, a bit of an homage as well to Toby Hooper's Poltergeist with the
I love Poltergeist, and that scene is just grotesque, and yeah, but the practical effects there are amazing.
And what I mean we've not even got into sort of the villain yet.
No,
I mean, that's all kind of the plot with the villain is very sort of nuts and bolts, but it's exactly what the film needs. You know, it's Shiwan Khan, who is the last descendant of Genghis Khan, and he has come to America to control a scientist played by Sir Ian McKellen, a pre-Magneto, pre-Gandalf Sir Ian McKellen, and could get him to make the first ever atomic bomb, basically. Mm. And that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I guess that's the plot. There's not much. We have the Shadow. We introduce the Shadow. He's introduced, and then the main plot is Margot Lane is the daughter of Ian McKellen, and she has some psychic kind of potential, similar powers. Because Khan has
psychic powers.
Has similar powers. So we're all the Shadow, Margot Lane, and Khan are linked by this kind of ability to cloud people's minds and communicate with each other to a point and other people and hit. Hypnotize people. They kind of use the description of the powers quite loosely. They don't really go into it. They kind of, but there's mass hypnotism.
I think this was in a time before we were so obsessed with. Well, how does that work?
Yeah.
What are the nuts? The nuts and bolts of that? I quite like that. And I can only describe as an honesty to the film.
Yeah.
It's not trying to be all things to all people. It's just a fun romp, and I don't.
Definitely.
I don't think you're allowed to make a fun romp in the same way. I mean, you can look at any MCU film and say it's a fun romp, but at the same time, there are certain boxes that it has to tick. And there's something quite refreshing about a film of this nature that doesn't have to do any world building, that doesn't have to set up a franchise.
I'm just thinking now that we were talking about that the origin of the Shadow is more mysterious and left in the kind of the dark, in the kind of pulp era in those magazines. But actually, in this film, it's the powers that are kind of left. Like, we find out where they're from or where they're learnt and where they're studied, but we don't have a specific, science to it as well.
It's inferred that it's something that anyone can do, but you've got to be taught, and there are some people for whom it is innate.
Yeah, they have a potential, more of a stronger potential, or it's easier for them to do. I think that's probably the more mysterious element of the Shadow, the aura of mystery.
Yeah.
So it's good that they kept that in, I think. Think about it now, I'm like, I don't need the nuts and bolts of it. I don't need the science of it.
No.
It is what it is. Do you think that, saying that it was a film of heightened reality.
Yes.
Do you think that a lot of audience might have deemed this as cheesy?
I think yes. I think that's probably, I think a lot of people sort of maybe didn't get it. I think it was, I mean, people look at the Tim Burton Batman films now and think they're campy because it's a post sort of Nolan vocabulary that we have.
Mm.
But I think a lot of the films of that nature took themselves quite seriously. And they were quite sort of dark, and the 90s were kind of a dark time in pop culture in a lot of ways. And I think that maybe it had a self-conscious nature, which wasn't quite what people were looking for then.
Yeah, I think it's kind of old school filmmaking.
Yes.
In the most classic sense of the word. But again, in the 90s, maybe, like you said, we weren't.
Wasn't quite what we were looking for. We weren't keyed into that anymore.
We moved on in terms of acting and films and what we wanted from them.
Yeah.
A few years later, The Matrix was released, and that's a very tonally very different film, very much so from what The Shadow is. But again, I really enjoy superhero period pieces.
Yes.
I think if you're going to do, like nowadays, a lot of people are like, how do we do James Bond? How do we do James Bond? I think you should take Bond back to the 60s.
Yeah.
I think that I would enjoy.
I think it works. I mean, I remember I was watching, to go on a bit of a tangent, I remember watching Spectre.
Mm.
And I've not seen a lot of the Bonds. I saw some of the Roger Moore one when I was a kid. But I remember just watching it and thinking, this guy's a real pig.
Misogynist,
horrible pig.
Yeah.
And I think that plays a lot better in the sort of early 60s than it does today.
The kind of the toxic masculinity of
I don't buy that no one
calls him one.
I mean, maybe they have elsewhere. I'm not a big Bond scholar. But,
my friend who's read most of the novels, I've always found Bond very kind of sexually aggressive.
Yes.
Like very kind of almost to the point of violence.
Yeah.
And, he does slap women around a bit. So did Shaft. There's a lot of that going on, unfortunately. But he said that in one of the novels, apparently he says, I think I might be killing a lot of Bond fans here, but apparently he says, This girl needs a good raping or something along those lines.
Yeah,
it's not great. So I think if you were to make comment on those times, if he was acting like that at those times, you could make comment on them and you could examine that if it was set back in the 60s. I think you can kind of make, not make excuses for it, but understand why he would act like that, or because of the kind of cultural, the cultural times, you know, I think that would make more sense. But him acting, like you said, him acting this way in modern times is like, you can't fucking do that. You shouldn't be doing that. That is totally inappropriate, the way you're behaving, the way you're acting. You need to get some serious mental help.
To sort of fleetingly return to the
Shagger. We're going back.
One thing that I did notice, actually, in terms of the relationship with the... I'd say love interest, but she's not really at all.
No.
There's a spark of romance between them, but it's not until literally sort of the very last scene that anything actually happens between them. And it's quite refreshing that they have a sort of a bit of sparring in their dialogue.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I really like that he tries to sort of use his hypnotic powers on her, but she's immune to it.
Mm.
And he doesn't know how to deal with that. And I love the fact that he starts off like with his sort of like, I'm charming millionaire sort of spiel. But then when he gets to know her and realizes what she's capable of, he's like, I've got to keep my distance from this. Like something is far too dangerous.
Yeah.
And then we realize that sort of like goes into his insecurities about himself and who he is and who he was, and the fact that she can see right through him. And I really, really appreciate that. And it's subtle. It's not like there isn't loads and loads of dialogue that goes into explaining it. It's just there in the subtext, but I appreciated the fact that it was there.
She doesn't have that many scenes. She's not in it a lot, but her presence is significant.
Mm-hmm.
But I like that she has a lot of agency as well. She's like, she's a strong woman. She's nice. She's flirty, you know. But she says, you know, he's like, do this, don't do this, I'm evil, don't come near me. And she's like, yeah, whatever, da, 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 da.
Yeah.
Right, I need to find my dad. You're going to help me find my dad. Let's go, I'll help, you know. And then he's like, well, I guess I'll have to help. And, you know, and their banter is quite fun.
Yeah.
What I'd like to talk about, speaking of banter,
yes.
I would like to talk about when Khan meets Lamont Cranston or the Shadow.
Yes.
I think that was a really, really cool scene.
Yeah. I was saying before, I'm a huge fan of whenever there is civil dialogue between a protagonist and an antagonist. I think one of the best examples I've seen done is Sherlock. You know that scene where he hears Moriarty coming up the stairs, so he puts tea on, which I think is the most quintessentially British thing you can do for your nemesis.
Yeah.
But I just love anything where you have mortal enemies exchanging sort of rapier, witty dialogue. Mm. That's my wheelhouse right there. And there's a couple of examples of that.
Oh, yeah. I think one of my favorites is the Green Goblin Spider-Man the Spider-Man movie, where he's like, you know, listen here. And he's slapping his head and stuff, and he's all drugged up. But it usually comes with the kind of, it's the classic kind of like the devil tempting Jesus thing, isn't it? It's always like, come, you know, we can be powerful, we can do things, we can rule this city, we can rule this world, you know, and that's similar to this scene as well.
Yeah, and as well, it works on a thematic level because you've got someone who is literally, he says like, oh, you're my idol, Yinko. Mm. I wanted to be just like you. You're my hero. So it's someone who's literally trying to pull him back into being that person again. So he's not only fighting against the villain, he's fighting against his former self.
Yeah.
And again, maybe they could have made more of that because it's quite a short film. I think it's less than 2 hours.
Yeah, it did. I was kind of like, oh, it's over.
Yeah,
kinda, a little bit.
I think
like,
it's maybe an hour and 40 minutes.
I felt like there was like more set pieces. Like I really remembered all the kind of big set pieces.
Yeah.
And the big set, like we said, it was on like a soundstage and all that sort of stuff. But I do, you know, I do like all the kind of physical, but like nowadays it would all be CG backgrounds, wouldn't it? But I did like all the physical kind of backgrounds and stuff. And I think as a kid, because I haven't seen it for quite a while, but I do, you know, I remember the more kind of, I remember mostly the most violent bits as a kid, you know, there's a bit where Khan is observing his new kingdom from the Empire State Building, and someone's like, nice dress, Mary, or something. like yeah. that. It's a kind of like cocky sailor walks by, and then he just like looks at the sailor. He gets these, they've got these wonderful like big contacts there that like the shadow has, like we were talking earlier about the shadow having the big black ones.
Yeah.
Khan has these kind of dark red ones.
Yeah, yeah. Like reddish kind of brown ones. Yeah. yeah. And, massive.
And he basically just looks at him and goes, I don't even remember what he says, but he basically gets the guy to climb up and yeah. jump off the Empire State Building.
He says anything in that one. I think he just looks at him and he does it. And he's talking to his mate. He's like, I've no idea what I'm doing.
Help me, help me. And he jumps off, and it's probably one of the more violent deaths I've seen.
He hits the side of the fucking building.
Yeah, he doesn't like, you don't just see him just like disappear through like the skyline. He hits like the bit that's jutting out towards the bottom. Like
I did not remember that.
It reminded me of Titanic, where the guy's screaming on the way down. He's like, ah! He hits the metal pole and it's just silent.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I really seem to remember those as a kid. I don't know. I think that's the, like for me, I always liked the things that were a little bit adult that yeah. had that element of, you know, they either had swearing in or, you know, like Goonies isn't like, you know, particularly, it's a kid's movie,
yeah, yeah,
but it still has quite a lot of adult elements and, you know,
yeah, yeah,
you know, romance, sexual romance, you know lots of other kind of dark stuff, you know, getting locked in a dungeon with a, you know, severely mentally disabled giant, you know, there's, you know, that could be quite scary because he thinks he's a monster, doesn't he? So
yeah,
at the time, so he could have been anything. And they're gonna kill him and cut his mouth off and lips off, I think they say.
It's been a very long time since I've seen it. Yeah, Dick Donner, wasn't it?
It was Dick Donner, yeah, and Spielberg produced. But yeah, I think the Goonies, I talk to a lot of people about the Goonies because I asked them, when did you see it? What age did you see The Goonies? Like, yeah. I was in my late 20s, or like, you're too old.
Yeah.
You're far too old. No wonder you hated it. But yeah, I was always interested in the kind of more adult stuff. I think I was fairly mature for a child. You know, I had a big beard and everything. So,
I've seen those baby pictures.
Yeah, they were quite scared. It's basically, my face looked like Alec Baldwin's chest.
Yeah.
But just not as ripped.
You've never seen a two-year-old with so much body hair or something.
They called me the wolf baby. but yeah, where were we? What were we talking about?
When I was a kid, Dark Crystal was my favourite film, and it still is to a certain extent.
They're bringing the Netflix show out, aren't they?
Yeah, I can't wait. But that's, like, I remember, like, I bought it on 4K quite recently, and it's amazing. But I showed Val, I was like, this is such an important part of my childhood. I'd really appreciate you watching this with me. And she got about 10 minutes in. She saw the Skeksis and she was like, fuck that. Yeah. No. Uh-uh.
I actually watched it with Josh. I quite enjoyed it.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's I liked the, obviously, the puppets and the animatronics and everything. Yeah, it was fun. I think I probably prefer Labyrinth if I had to kind of compare two films.
But when you're 6 years old, that film,
oh my God, that's
everything.
That is the shit. Yeah, I could imagine that. But yeah, so what can we talk about? Where were we?
Might be an idea if we talked a bit about The Shadow.
Maybe, yeah, I know, right? It was a radio show.
Yeah.
And Orson Welles played The Shadow. So obviously Orson Welles is a big, big name actor, famous, one of the, you know, Citizen Kane, you know, name it, Third Man, Transformers the movie. He was a Unicron in the planet eating Unicron.
That pee advert where he had his big tantrum. Do you remember that?
I don't think I saw
it. There was a transcript of, he was recording an advert for peas. And he has a full on tantrum about like how unrealistic the dialogue is.
That sounds like awesome.
Yeah.
But he, like I think that Alec Baldwin would have seen him stepping into the shoes of Orson Welles. I feel like that was like a challenge for him. It was something because he probably admired the man as the actor.
I mean, there's a bit of Orson Welles in his dialogue Shadow. Yeah, that, I mean, he's got quite a kind of a bit of a sort of husky, raspy voice anyway, but he leans right into it when he's The Shadow.
Actually, why don't we talk about some of the other characters? So we have Ian McKellen,
yes,
who is one of my favourite actors. And unfortunately, almost the entirety of this film, he is hypnotized.
He's not in it very much.
No.
And he's, I think he's, it's a part that's got a lot of heart and a lot of, he's kind of like, he's the kindly sort of uncle, avuncular.
Yeah.
Scientist,
I'm very interested in my work. I'll be honest, the one thing I didn't really believe was him that he didn't know the difference between red and green.
Yeah, well, he's meant to be colorblind, isn't he?
Oh, is he colorblind?
Yeah.
Right, okay, now I get it. I thought he was just like, duh.
I think when people are colorblind, they're the two colors that get
because
confused,
they're quite,
aren't they?
Relatively similar. No, I didn't realize he was colorblind. I thought he was just so like invested in his work that he never knew the difference between red and green.
Like Sherlock Holmes. Yeah. He has a set amount of like space in his brain and he can accommodate.
Almost like maybe on an autistic level or something. I don't know.
That could have, that's a perfectly valid reading. I think just thought, colorblind.
Yeah, no, I probably should have read it as colorblind, but I was just like, it just comes across as, you know, I don't know. But, sorry, listeners. One of my action figures, yes, ladies, action figures, has fallen off the shelf.
I reckon the shadow knocks it down.
Did it? The shadow of the shadow. the shadow knows, so he'll know
the shadow does know.
He knows that's fallen over, and he's not come and picked it up.
He knows how
unhappy
he'll be about it. Yeah?
It's all right. It's pretty. They're pretty flexible, and it's not like a statue or something. They'll bend.
It's all good.
It's all good. I'll pick it up later. Anyway, so enough about shadowy ghosts.
We've also got Tim Curry.
Yes.
Tim Pennywise Frankenfurter Curry.
Yes. he's an interesting one in this.
He's all over the place.
Yeah. Every scene he's a little bit like, first of all, he's kind of a bit like he's the annoying kind of not lab assistant. He's another scientist.
Yeah,
that works nearby or in the same building as Ian McKellen's character.
And he's very sort of lascivious towards Margot, isn't he? Yeah. Penelope Ann Miller's character.
Because he keeps saying, "There's a great line where he's like, when are you going to come see my beryllium sphere?" And she's like, "I frankly don't want to have anything to do with your beryllium spheres. Thank you very much." Which I think is a great line.
I love when he says, "You don't return my calls anymore." He says, "Well, that's not true. I never did return your call."
Yeah. Why is that? But yeah, and then the next scene we see him in, he's going, he's just full on kind of maniacal.
Yeah.
Like, who's got a better maniacal laugh in this film? Alec Baldwin or Tim Curry?
It's a difficult choice. And on the subject of the laugh, that's one thing that I think got me as a kid. I love the fact that you had this character who was invisible, but he was like laughing, and you got this blood curdling laugh reverberating around your space, and like he could be whispering in your ear, and you can't shoot him. And I'm like, that's badass as fuck. Like, why doesn't Batman laugh from the shadows?
Yeah.
That'd make people shit themselves.
Yeah,
and I really like that, and it's one of my favorite things about the mythology. Actually,
I think the laugh is very important. It's very telling, because I mean, for like the mystery of the shadow is, for me, he seems to like the criminals are as you know, they're a suspicious and superstitious and cowardly lot. So the fact that he kind of promotes himself as a kind of ghostly figure, a spectral figure. Like, he could be anywhere. You can't see him. You don't, you know. Luckily, he's in all these very echoey places.
Yeah.
Every set piece is in a very echoey place. So
he doesn't fight crime in places with bad acoustics.
And I don't do podcasts in places with bad acoustics. But yeah, I think the maniacal collapse, because there's got to be something to terrify a criminal. Mm-hmm. You've got to terrify them in some way, and Batman does it in his own way, in his own unique style. And again, he's promoting that fear, and he's kind of selling that and creating this supernatural creature. He's very human. He's very human. Like, he's very strong, and you know, he has gadgets and all that. But the shadow is closer to what Batman is pretending to be. So it's almost like Batman's pretending to be the shadow.
Yes.
But the shadow is pretending to be a ghost, but he's closer to that because of the powers.
Theatricality and deception are powerful agents.
Certainly are. And I was thinking about Khan. I think I said it to you before we recorded that if they were ever going to do a proper live action Mandarin, I would want to see something like this.
Yeah.
Like, because it's not offensive. It's not a caricature.
No.
You know, it's done very well, very, you know, honestly. I think probably the way they could argue this is that it's obviously set in the 30s. So there's, you know.
Before racism was
before
bad.
Before racism even existed. The origins of racism. No, let's not get too political, please. Let's just talk about the film. I think it was great portrayal. By the actor, I want to say his name was
John Lone.
Sorry,
he was in quite a lot of things, but Fast and Furious, Rush Hour. That's the thing that it stands out for me.
Oh, is he playing Rush Hour?
I don't remember.
Yeah.
But I like looking at his IMDb page, that was one thing that sort of stood out.
Fair enough. But I thought he was fantastic. I thought he was really, his delivery, his acting, you know, it was phenomenal.
Yeah.
And like we were saying, the special effects as well were incredible. Like, it was a good mix of different types of special effects.
And I was expecting, because quite often when I revisit a film from the 90s that I love, I think, don't hold up quite as well as I remember, but I was astonished by how well the effects in this film hold up. They really do look great.
I mean, even the CGI, I think the dagger is CGI. I'm pretty sure that dagger with the face, Buddha face.
There's in the film, the Tulku has a sort of sentient dagger called the Purba. And
I'm glad you knew what it was called. Yeah, I had no idea.
It's CGI, but when you compare it to other CGI of that era, it's really, it's well composited. It looks good within the shot. The textures, like you said, were really, really well done.
Yeah. It's like it was actually bronze, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And I thought that, like, it can't be CG. It looks too good. Could that be stop motion? But it's too seamless to be
stop motion. No, it's definitely not stop motion. I don't think there's any stop motion that I can think of. The shadows seemed like they're animated, like they're hand drawn, just because the smoothness of them and the way they move. But yeah, I you know, you don't need to defend this film to me because this is great.
Like, I need to defend it to the people of 1994.
Yeah, just go back.
They are.
I think you need to go back in time. Get some, you know, get your flux capacitor fluxing and go back and say you're wrong.
Yeah,
world, you are wrong. And I think people will go back now and retroactively watch this and go, what was the problem with this? Like, why? It's just it's so much that, like, it's all about timing, I think, a lot of films and the reason why things aren't remembered. I watched William Friedkin's Sorcerer, which is an incredible film, but it came out the same time as Star Wars.
Yeah.
And just flopped, and it's an amazing film. It's very gripping, very different to Star Wars, obviously, but unfortunately, like, he directed The French Connection, he directed Exorcist, so this was, like, high on the list of everyone's, like, must watch, but Star Wars just mowed it down.
I think, there is an argument for just being in the wrong place at the wrong time, and I think as well, just in terms of where the tastes are, in terms of what else is on at the cinema at the time.
Yeah.
I think that every now and then you just get a film that falls through the cracks. And I think this is, I mean, I don't know what sort of budget to return was going on there, but I don't think it made an awful lot of money. Everyone I've spoken to about it remembers it fondly. The people who did see it seem to have liked it, but it just seems like general audiences maybe weren't there for it quite as much as they should be.
I don't know. I'm just going to look at my notes, see if there's any other things that I really kind of want to discuss. Not really. I think we've kind of covered the majority of it.
Can I very quickly talk about what my choice was going to be?
Oh, okay.
Just very, very quickly. Okay. I want to talk about it.
All right. Yeah, sure. We've got a lot of time. Let's fill it.
I want to talk about Justice League very quick.
Ooh.
Because it's really hard being a fan of Justice League because Marvel fans don't like it because they say it's Marvel light.
Mm-hmm.
DC fans don't like it because, I mean, fuck me. DC fandom on Twitter.
Oh God.
They call it Justice League. Ugh. They're very, very vociferous in their hatred of it. But for all the fact that there's a lot of awesome stuff that clearly ended up on the cutting room floor and it feels like a compromised film, but I can't take away from the fact that watching it, I just had the best time and I was so happy to see these characters together for the first and, you know, in light of recent news, probably the last
time.
And it just really saddens me. I mean, there's never say never. I mean, like, I'm still reeling from the fact that Ben Affleck is officially out as Batman.
Yeah,
we've
suspected
it for a long time, but there's always a possibility that he could come back and that Henry Cavill could come back. And I think it would be extraordinarily remiss of Warner Brothers if they. So, I mean, by all means, go out in different directions. I'm really liking what I'm seeing of Birds and Prey. Birds of Prey and whatnot.
Birds of Prey.
Fuck yes, make Batgirl, make Supergirl, you know, define your USP as different to the Marvel.
Definitely.
By all means, but don't burn down the house you've half built, you know?
Yeah.
And I think the success of Aquaman is encouraging, but I think you know, for all the fact, all the things that are frustrating about Justice League, which I totally get, and I totally get, you know, but for me, like the dodgy CGI stash in that first scene doesn't detract from the fact that it's a really sweet scene that gives me a good taste of what Superman was about.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that we didn't see enough of the Flash or his origin story or the Arius West scene doesn't detract from the fact that, like, this is a Flash that's got loads and loads of potential for the big screen. I think it's just... I'm just upset that it didn't do better because I think there is a lot of things that the film did right for all the things it did wrong. And I think in a world where the Avengers never came out, I think that film does do better.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But in a film where the Avengers did come out, I can totally understand why it didn't.
Yeah.
But that is a film I will defend, not just in secret, but in public.
Yeah, definitely.
With weaponry if needs be, with bare hands if not. But no, it's something I vociferously love, but I think the reason I chose The Shadow is because I thought you might want something that's got a bit more of a sort of whole
edge. Definitely. I think Justice League might become almost kind of cool, in a way. I think even Suicide Squad is slowly becoming
A bit cool
too. Like, I know a lot of people talk about wanting to see the Zack Snyder cut.
Yes.
I want to see the David Ayer cut of Suicide Squad.
Well, yeah, there was, again, a lot of interesting stuff seems to have went up on the cutting.
Yeah, wasn't it someone on YouTube cut a trailer and then the final cut was by them?
Yes.
Yeah, is that correct?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's crazy to think that just one, you know, I could have edited a video on YouTube and then I could just be like, yeah, I'll just edit a whole, you know, Justice League multi-million dollar picture.
I don't know if it was someone on YouTube or an actual, like, production house.
Yeah, proper, yeah, someone who does
things. But yeah, that's why I heard that, like, whoever cut the trailer was given the actual film. Because,
yeah.
I mean, if you look at, I remember quite vividly when the first Suicide Squad trailer came out, it was much more dark and much more morose and somber. And then Batman v Superman came out and that happened.
Yeah.
And then the next trailer. Yeah. And that was like Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3.
It was an absolute turnaround. But I mean, when I went to see Justice League, I really enjoyed it. I came out going, that was good. You know, it wasn't amazing. Like, I wasn't absolutely blown away, but I did enjoy seeing those characters. And again, like, I'm quite soft on kind of harsh criticism when it comes to comic book movies.
Yeah.
Like Suicide Squad, I came out and go, I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
And
I acknowledge that I'm an incredibly easy lay when it comes to comic
movies. Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Like, and they're like, oh, God, another Spider-Man film. I'm like, yeah, but...
You've got to really fuck it up for me tonight.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You've got to really, like spirit level fuck it up. You know, there's comic book films I do not like. You know, I know you're quite a big fan of Green Lantern.
Yeah.
I love Daredevil. I love the director's cut of Daredevil.
Director's cut is a good film. It's a good film. Yeah.
Yeah. Ghost Rider, I hate. You know, there's so many that I'm just like, but there's a lot of them I forgive. Like the Tim story of Fantastic Fours. I forgive a lot in that.
There's a lot to like about those.
But
films.
There's some great performances and there's a lot. So I'm quite forgiving. And a lot of my friends are like, you know, they'll ask me about a superhero film. They're like, if you say it's good, I'm going to take that down by 50%. Yeah. So I'm like, all right. But for the most, when I say it's good and they come out, they go, actually, that was great. Like Thor Ragnarok, I saw it last week. Let's go see it again. He's like, you want to see it again? I was like, I want to see it again. And they were like, right. And they went, actually, yeah, that was great. And I was like, yes, some of them are amazing.
For Ragnarok, I remember vividly we did an episode of Nerdy.
Yeah, we did.
I wasn't at all as convinced by it as you guys
there
were.
You go, yeah.
Going back into it, like I kind of once I get okay, this is what it is. Stop trying to watch what the film wasn't and watch what the film was.
I think you've discussed it a few times, and I do believe that you do go in with preconceptions.
Yeah,
the film you want to see. I think Last Jedi was. Like so typical of that. Everyone had created they'd done all their fan theories.
Yes.
You know, they've done all this. They're like, it's this, it's that, it's this. And we go into the film. Like I loved Last Jedi.
Yeah.
And
good.
I thought it was great. I thought it was one of the first films I'd seen in years when it felt like a cinematic event.
Mm.
It wasn't just a film, and even Infinity War didn't feel like necessarily a cinematic event to me, but Last Jedi did.
Mm.
And the second Luke throws that lightsaber away, I went, this is going to be something.
We're not in Kansas.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to be something I've never seen before. It's going to be absolutely unique. And I love that they're just chucking shit out. They're throwing stuff away they don't need. You know, I don't care about, I know some fans will be like, oh, continuity, this, Knights of Ren, blah, 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 blah. But the fact that I was not expecting that reaction, the reaction I got was the exact opposite of what I could ever conceive of, thought about, you know, for 2 years worth of waiting, or 3 years, however long it's been since the first, the Force Awakens. I was like, I'm in for this. So in for this because this is totally going to be a totally unpredictable film in so many ways. And I was well up for it. I love that film.
I think, do you know what, a big part of why you and I like these films more than most, I think, is like part of it is our age.
Yeah.
Because we've grown up in an era where this stuff didn't come along two or three times a year. We got one every 3 or 4 years if we were lucky.
Yeah, we were lucky to get a Shadow. The Shadow.
And I think that maybe, I hate to use the word entitled, but I think a lot of these kids today, I think they just haven't grown up with that. I think they've grown up with such an abundance of that stuff. And like kids growing up at the time, or like coming into adulthood at the time when the Nolan trilogy was coming out, stuff like that, they've had a proliferation of it, and a lot of it's been good. And I think maybe that has made them less tolerant of ambitious.
We've been spoiled.
Yeah,
we have been totally, totally spoiled. And I do think maybe there is a time, like a lot of people are like, oh, the comic book movie's going to collapse. It's going to, you know, it's going to go into a dive. People aren't going to go see it. At the moment, there's no way that's happening.
There's too much variety. And I think what I think we should, even if you are a hardcore DC guy like I am, I think one thing you have to be very grateful to the MCU for is showing you can tell all kinds of stories with comic book properties. Everything doesn't have to fit the superhero mold.
No.
You know, you can have something like a Doctor Strange, which shares quite a lot of connective tissue with the Shadow.
Yeah.
Like
there was a sequence where Khan's looking at something and it's kind of, it looks like it becomes a kind of glyph, like in Doctor Strange.
Does that trippy sort of effect? Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, there's a bold master in you know, who teaches the lead character how to do what he does.
Oh shit, it does have an ancient one.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It basically has an ancient one. I do, you know, it's a shame that people are so down on the DC movies. Like at the moment, all I'm reading is DC comics.
Mm.
Comics wise, all I'm reading. It's all I'm downloading because basically in the early 90s and the early 90s and the like early noughties, there was loads of DC books that were like, you must read this, you must read this, you must read this. But there wasn't any collections. And I'm very much a graphic novel, you know, trade paperback kind of guy.
Yes.
And I will buy single issues, don't get me wrong, but it's very rare that I'll do it if I absolutely have to.
Yeah.
I'd rather have a collection, even if I have to pay top dollar for
it. Yeah, me too, yeah.
And there were so many, and now they're releasing all those. And DC comics are great. Like, I'm a big Marvel fan. I love Spider-Man, you know, hence the title of the podcast, you know. Spider-Man's over there as a figure form, you know.
There's a lot of over Marvel stuff.
This is like the cave of the spider cave, if you will, the podcaster spider down HQ, Secret Wars HQ. But, you know, I love DC as well, equally. Like, it's not bad. There's always like this perceived war. And I've never really got behind that.
I don't think that benefits anyone, this sort of polarity that, and as you see it, I mean, as much as I love being a DC fan, you see it a lot in the DC fan community.
Oh, definitely.
I tweeted something saying, the MCU is the Beatles, the DCU is the Rolling Stones.
I thought you were going to say the Monkees.
But I thought that was a pretty good analogy that came to me.
I think you're right. Yeah.
And somebody replied, and I'm not knocking them because it's someone I respect, but they said like the MCU is McDonald's, the DCU isn't. And I think that's just needlessly dismissive.
No, that's not fair. That's not fair.
Because it's, I mean,
if you know,
it's an easy criticism to level at the MCU, but at the same time, I don't think it's one that has merit because they're not as cookie cutter as the detractors would have you believe.
Exactly.
I mean, there's tremendous variety in the MCU.
There's obviously tropes, but they're, you know, the hero's journey, you know, is full of those kind of tropes anyway. You know, any story, like there's only, what do they say? There's only five types of story that are ever told.
Yeah.
And then we just repeat them. You know, we live in a postmodern modern world where stories have been repeated so much, and there, you know, there's very little kind of variety and difference in that. But you know, a superhero film is a superhero film. I do expect certain things out of a superhero film, you know, like I would expect from The Shadows. Shadow delivered on all the tropes and things that I would expect in a superhero film as well.
But to take it back to The Shadow, I think I'm going to start off today and then take it back. But like, I think today Marvel and the MCU have shaped so much of our preconceptions and expectations when it comes to comic book properties on film.
Yes.
I think when you have something that's ambitious, but doesn't fit that mold, like Batman v Superman, a film, and that for me is a film that just keeps on giving. You know, every time I watch it, I notice a nuance or something there that I didn't quite get before.
I'm very, very glad you showed me the director's cut.
Yeah,
like I was a bit reticent at first, but I was like, why didn't this one go to the cinema?
Yeah,
because I don't think there would have been as many detractors.
Yeah, I think executive mismanagement is the only answer I can come up with. But it does seem that, like, I mean, maybe that cut would have got a better reception. But I think that it is as with The Shadow, it is that thing of, well, yeah, this is this, but it's not that. And what we want right now is that. And I think what's great about cult film as a phenomenon is this idea of going back and vindicating films that, I mean, the best example is Blade Runner, because Blade Runner wasn't at all well received in its time, but now it's widely regarded as one of the greatest science fiction films of all time.
There's like it almost goes the exact opposite. It becomes, you know, it's despised cult, and then it becomes so well loved that it doesn't become cult anymore. Like I think you know, Blade Runner and Rocky Horror are not necessarily cult anymore. Because they are so well liked by the mainstream audience that they're not even really that.
They've come full circle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's strange. Like, I watched a film the other night, Night of the Creeps, which is kind of this love letter to like B-50s B movies.
Yeah,
had the recently passed Dick Miller in it as well, and it's amazing, a lot of fun. But again, you know, was not seen, was despised, was hated. But like our friends, I think Super Nerds UK helped with the recent Blu-ray release, I think, in the UK. Really good guys. You should listen to their podcast if you're not already listening. Fantastic guys, love them. And they do so many conventions and stuff as well.
Yeah, yeah, they're very busy. Yeah.
Yeah, very busy guys. It's strange how things do. Like, I think nowadays we are, like you were saying, we like nostalgia.
Yes.
We want nostalgia. We enjoy nostalgia. Like you were talking about, you know, the scary present as opposed to, you know, the kind of golden past we kind of keep looking at.
Familiarity is the word. Yeah. We want familiarity, and especially when it costs you the better part of a tenner to go to the cinema.
Yeah.
You want to know what you're getting for your money. You want familiarity. You want comfort food. You know, that's why we, like, if you're going to draw a McDonald's analogy, you go to McDonald's because you want comfort food. You know, you get a big Domino's pizza because you want comfort food. It's not because you want nourishment.
Stop
or
it. I might have to go get a pizza now.
You know, you don't want to be challenged by Domino's, you know? And I think that's maybe if that's one thing that we crave at the expense of all else. But sometimes, you know, sometimes somebody will make a really good broccoli dish, like Batman v Superman.
Yeah.
or
a Marmite dish.
You know, like, there's room for films that break the mold,
challenge your expectations.
Yeah, and as well, like, one last thing I realize I'm going on a bit of a tangent.
No, do it. I love this.
I want to say is, like, I've noticed a lot of film criticism today revolves around plot. It revolves around what happens, what people do, what people say.
Right.
And I think that's a disingenuous way to look at film, because there's so much else. There's production design, there's the art of visual effects. You know, one of my least favorite criticisms is, oh, that CGI is a bit ropey, because I think if you know someone who works in digital animation, you know how hard they work, you know how difficult it is, and you know how, and compositing, fuck me, compositing's a hard, like, getting something.
And sometimes studios will rush productions, people. So
I mean, that's the reason why, to go back to Justice League, the infamous top lip, it looks, in some scenes, I'm sorry, you cannot tell it's there, but in others it's painfully obvious, and it's just a case, it's not that they did a shit job, it's just they were pushed for time.
Exactly.
And you see, resources.
I actually shared something with Violet the other day, and it was like, when an artist is given like when they're paid and when they're not paid, and it was like a bird, and the bird was like really detailed, like blue tit, and the next photo was just a wavy line, like a little wavy line, and I thought that was spot on, because like artists are like, they go, oh yeah, I need 200 exposures to pay my rent this week, you know, things like that. But yeah, it's a shame, and there's so many great films, like modern films, that maybe in, you know, one day will become. I think Suicide Squad could probably become a cult film.
Yeah.
You know, I really enjoyed it for the performances and the characters.
There's a lot of good stuff there, and like with The Shadow, so much of it, like we said, was ahead of its time. Like some fantastic visual effects, some fantastic production design, and again, it just, like, narratively, it's not the strongest film.
No,
it's got a very, very nuts and bolts narrative, but for me, I don't come to a period piece film noir pulp movie for narrative. I come to be transported into another world, and I think in that respect it does its job phenomenally well.
The set pieces are amazing. I like I said, as a child, I remember all the set pieces because they're fantastical, and they're amazing, they're well done, and they're unique, and they're stylized, and even the poster is such a stylized poster. Gorgeous. And the Shadow is such a, you know, despite being a mostly radio character, he's a very recognizable presence.
Yeah.
I know they've recently done some comics where Batman has teamed up with the Shadow, which I'm very much looking forward to read. I might even buy some after this podcast.
Do you know what? I've got a bunch of Shadow comics on my iPad, and I think it's Howard Chaykin did a run in the 90s, and I've got those, and there's some recent ones. There's Matt Wagner did some, I've got those, and I'm now motivated, I'm excited,
thank you very much for like bringing this film back to my attention.
It's really my pleasure.
It's so much fun. I really enjoyed watching it with you.
I'm glad we were able to share
this together, and it makes my heart glad to kind of feel a little bit of that old nerdify kind of love and stuff.
It's a nice feeling, guys. If you haven't seen The Shadow, please do yourselves a favor and watch it. I think you could probably get it for about £5 on iTunes or
YouTube. I think do it, maybe Amazon, maybe.
Or if you're a physical guy like me, I got it on Blu-ray from Amazon for just a bit over a tenner. It's a film experience that will reward you if you give it the opportunity and go into it with an open mind.
Exactly. I want to do one last thing before you go. Now, last time I had a...
Shall I get the Vaseline?
You'd be lucky. So in the last podcast I did with the Secret Defenders with Angry Andy Knowles, I introduced a cult film test, which is kind of 71 questions to say whether this is a cult film. It's kind of a
71.
We'll try and blitz through them as quick as we can. Are you ready?
Okay,
you ready? Here we go.
I'm caffeinated.
Here we go. So we've got 20 minutes. We can do it in 20 minutes. Fine. So, does it feature excessive violence?
No, I wouldn't say so.
I mean, there's a bit where...
For a character whose signature weapon is two pistols, there's extraordinarily little shooting.
And there's a lot of swords, and there's even the crossbow of the two guards get crossbowed.
Yes.
And there is literally no blood.
It's mostly people falling off buildings.
Yeah, quite violently. Okay, next one. Does it feature buckets of blood?
No. Barely any. There's little dribbles here and there.
Yeah, I think it's just like out of his mouth, or, you know, he's got a bullet wound, but very kind of tame, but not like gushing or anything.
But you know, it has almost no blood. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And I would very much regard that as a cult film.
Yeah, even the chainsaw sequence, you don't really see it.
Barely any.
I mean, I think Psycho has more blood.
Yeah.
Anyway, next one. Does it feature over-the-top acting?
Yeah. I'd say, yeah.
There's a slightly campy element, but it's not
naturalistic.
No, definitely not. And it's not a disservice to The Darkness or, you know, that tone either. It kind of works. It works all together. So does it feature a ludicrous premise?
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I'd say yes. So let's go. Do you mind if you count these up? Count the amount. So we've got
the amount of wins.
Yeah, so two so far. Yeah, sorry, I forgot to mention that.
I've only got 10 fingers though, you realize.
Right. Okay, I'll do it as well.
Fingers.
I'll do it as well. I mean,
I'll try and do two.
We'll try. Yeah. So an experienced elder actor. Does it feature an elder experienced actor?
Yes, Sarah McCollum.
There we go. Fantastic. Does it feature quotable dialogue?
Oh, big time.
Yeah, he's got his catchphrases, hasn't he? So,
The Shadow knows.
Does it feature a martial arts display?
Yeah.
I'd argue the sword swinging.
Yeah.
I'd say that's kind of there.
We'll go with that.
Does it feature gunplay?
A little bit.
Yeah?
A little bit. More than none.
There's two. He's got two guns.
Yeah.
There's a lot of Tommy gun action.
Yes.
If you like Tommy guns, this is the film. Does it feature a professional sport?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
No, I don't think so. Does it feature body swapping?
There's
that dream sequence, but
kind of possession as well. Like...
Yeah. No, not like I mean active body swap, like proper body swap.
Right, no.
Freaky Friday.
No,
body swapping.
Okay, fair enough then.
Okay. So does it feature smart characters making stupid decisions? A la Prometheus.
I mean there's a smart character who is brainwashed by hypnotism, so mm-hmm.
But he's not. Yeah, he's not making the decisions actively, though, is he?
I'm sure if I had longer to think about it, I'd be able to identify one.
We'll find something. But... does it feature anything non-threatening made threatening?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head.
Okay. Does it feature machismo?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very sort of genteel 30s machismo.
Oh, yeah.
But machismo. He does that thing where he's got a really high waistband, the hex is sticking out the top.
Yeah, that is. He's got that.
That's pretty fucking. And that chest hair, come on.
But yeah, that is. I mean, that's definitely a tick for machismo. How many are we on so far?
Seven.
Does it feature dance choreography?
No.
No. Does it feature a metric ton of drugs?
No. Well,
there is. Well, yes.
They're in opening scene. Drugs.
Opening scene.
You don't see them, but they're there.
They're in opium field.
Yeah. I'm having that.
Yeah, let's have that. Does it feature pseudoscience?
Oh, fuck. Big time. Yeah.
Atomic bombs.
Beryllium spheres. Yeah. Come on.
Does it feature a post-apocalyptic world?
Not yet.
Does it feature. Give it time. Does it feature sexual fetishes?
Kind of.
Yeah. Which one? Which one are we?
Sexy lady fetish.
If you're attracted to sexual ladies, that's your fetish. A diverse cast? Does it feature a diverse cast? It is quite diverse.
Very diverse, yeah.
Does it feature a heist?
No.
Does it feature a montage?
No, but it should.
It should have.
It really should have had
that
a montage.
That opening scene where he's like, I'm training, should have been a montage.
We need a montage!
What the fucking montage? Does it feature Cold War politics?
No, pre-Cold War.
Does it feature a grizzled cop?
Kind of. His uncle's a grizzled cop. Yeah. Well, he's just fat and indifferent.
Yeah. I'll let you decide on that one.
Okay.
Does it feature a conspiracy?
Kind of, yeah. He wants to destroy the world, create a new empire.
Yeah, he does it through agents.
Yeah.
The Shadow's probably created a conspiracy all by himself. Anyway,
we'll have it.
Agents. Yeah. Does it feature a resurrection?
Kind of. You could say that Yinko died and he's resurrected as Lamont Cranston.
Oh, you're playing around with these questions, aren't you? Yeah, fair enough. Does it feature an unconventional love story?
I would argue that it's unconventional. Yeah, they're psychic people who fall in love.
Yeah, fair enough. How are we doing on numbers?
14.
14. Cool. Does it feature sports cars?
No.
Does it feature little people?
Not really. No.
No. Does it feature an animal in a starring role?
No.
Does it feature a strong female lead?
Yes.
Yeah, cool. Does it feature noir-like narration?
No.
No, it should have had. Should have had something. Does it feature Japanese weaponry?
Yes. Well, no. Tibetan, Mongolian.
Yeah. Does it feature creepy children?
No.
No creepy kids, no.
You'd expect that to be, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Well, is the guy at the start kind of the child, the talker?
Oh, yeah, okay.
He's a creepy child, because he's got like a very like menacing voice, hasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'll have that.
Go on then. Does it feature bullies?
No.
Does it feature Nazi-themed anything?
No, it's pre-Nazi.
Pre-Nazi. Does it feature a trending fad at the time?
Difficult to
yeah, because it's a period piece.
No.
Does it feature LGBT content?
If it does, then it's very, very implicit.
Mm.
Ian McKellen's in it. Can we have that?
Yeah, go on. I'll let you have that. Does it feature body horror?
Yes, face.
I'd say the face is body horror.
Yeah, definitely.
Does it feature an idiot character?
Oh, fuck yeah.
Tim Curry.
Yeah.
Tim Curry is the idiot character. Does it feature punk, rock, or rap music?
No.
Does it feature a celebrity cameo?
Not really, no.
Does it feature supernatural powers?
Yes. Big time.
Yeah, huge yes. Does it feature time travel?
No.
Does it feature space travel?
No.
Does it feature an exorcism?
No.
Does it feature
so many missed opportunities?
I know. Well, this is like the last film we looked at, Bad Lieutenant, was very, it was a very much cult film, but again, it didn't get score very well.
Okay.
Does it feature a child protagonist?
No.
Does it feature nerds?
No, pre-nerd.
Pre-nerd. Does it feature the military?
Wait. I'd argue that Serena McCallum's character is a nerd.
I'll give you that. I'll allow that. Does it feature the military? There are military guards.
Yes.
They get killed. Does it feature a crazed killer?
Yes.
Does it feature a vigilante?
Yes.
Does it feature cults?
Yes. His Mongol warriors are called.
Yep. Aliens?
No.
Vampires?
No.
Zombies?
No.
Wizards?
No. Wait. Kind of.
Kind of wizards.
Well, it's wizardry, isn't it?
It's a wizard. Yeah, it's a form of wizardry.
Yeah.
It's supernatural.
Yeah.
Go on then. I mean, they're kind of like shaman, kind of. Yeah, I'll have that. Mythical creatures.
Kind of. The Berbers, I would argue, a mythical creature.
Yeah, okay, I'll give you that.
Sentient weaponry.
Yeah, I'll give you that. Mutants.
No.
Ghosts.
No.
Robots.
No.
Demons.
No.
Witches. Wait,
No.
Kaiju.
No.
Monsters.
Not really. Not in the literal sense
of monsters. Apes.
No.
Samurai.
That would be historically inaccurate.
Yeah. Ninjas.
Again,
same again.
Yeah.
Gangsters.
Yes. Yeah. Big time.
Cool. Vincent Price.
No, but that's, now that I think about it, that's the thing that this film was missing.
Yeah. I think Tim Curry could have been replaced easily with Vincent Price. Obviously.
He could have been the Tulku. That would have been pretty awesome.
Or he could have been the scientist.
Yes.
Again, it's like a hypnotized role. I don't know if he'd go for that. Samuel Jackson. Does it feature Samuel Jackson?
No.
Final question. Does it feature Nick Cage?
No, but again, it should have.
Okay, so out of 71 points, how much did it make?
A measly 28.
28?
Yeah. Mm.
So the cult film test is our barometer for how cult this film is. So probably not so cult.
It's however, not so cult.
However, I will override the test.
The test isn't the boss of us.
No, the test isn't the boss of us. I just like it as a kind of, you know, as kind of a scale. Kind of see how crazy, how cult. Because some cult films get pretty damn crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, some of the questions I've listed could have easily been in one film.
by that test, there's no way Blade Runner is a cult film.
That's not, yeah. Blade Runner wouldn't win that
or
test.
Or Mad Max.
Yeah.
Or pretty much any cult film I can think of.
I think this is kind of, it's more kind of Grindhouse, I think. I mean, I think we just see how well we do.
I want to see the film that ticks all 71 of those boxes.
I want to make it now. I'm going to make that. If anyone wants to try and make that film happen, please, please let me know.
I have had it with these motherfucking creepy child ninja samurai on this motherfucking sports car.
That was a lot of ticks in that one alone. Right, I think we've come to the end of our journey, of our road. I'm surprised. Like, I had a lot of questions planned, but I think we could kind of just blitz through them anyway and answer
sometimes
them all.
Sometimes, yeah, the flow of the conversation just sort of works.
And but no, it's you know, it's great having you back as a podcast.
It's
partner.
Great to be back, dude. I honestly, I've kind of surprised myself with how much I missed it.
Yeah,
and how much it sort of like comes back to you.
Yeah,
so you're just a bit nervous about getting back into it.
I think like for me, it's like once I kind of mastered everything, it was just getting back into the swing of it. And I think for me, I prefer the ones when someone's here. There's a bit more variety, I have conversation going, you get flow going. I don't mind doing the ones on my own. I think they're great.
Yeah, cool. No, they are. They really are. And I think you're better at doing that than I think I did one or maybe two of the Notified podcast on my own. And oh, it nearly killed me, because when you have no one to bounce off, there's just so little energy and it just is really flat. And you listen back to it and you think, oh, that feels really flat.
Yeah.
People said nice things about the one I did on my own, but like, I just...
You did feel like
right. Shit.
I did a similar one where I scripted it and it was that was flat. That was cold and flat, and I didn't like that. And when I heard it back, I was like, I think I ended up accidentally deleting it anyway. But I physically deleted it, because I was just like, this is not. It doesn't feel right. Doesn't feel natural. Doesn't feel conversational. Even when I'm on my own, I still want to have a kind of conversation.
Yeah,
feel.
It's hard. Something that flows beautifully when you write it just falls incredibly flat.
Yeah, and you're like, and you can't get your mouth around anything. So, but yeah.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
And I want to have you again. I'm thinking about doing a few more different segments. So I'm thinking about doing one where we talk about directors. I'm going to call it Wrong Direction.
Okay.
And we talk about lesser known films from big name directors.
So, I'd be delighted to. I can think of some examples.
I think you'd be great on that. I think we could get we could pick a really good film, really unique film. I've got some ideas myself. There's a few that. What was the other one I wanted to do? I want to do Backstage Past as well. I did a little bit one on the Superman Curse.
Yes.
Which I quite enjoyed doing. I'd like to look at other kind of production hells on movies. So things like Fitzcarraldo and Justice League.
Or
Batman. You could talk about those as well. And I'm going to do another section as well, which is Spider Knights of the Round Table, which is just round table discussions about subjects, about comics, Spider-Man, films, cult films.
Do you know what we could do?
Yeah.
We could do for Nerdify listeners. I love you all. Thank you so much for keeping us.
We are missed. I know we are missed.
As long as we did. Yeah. But Nerdify listeners would be interested to know there is actually a lost episode of Nerdify, where we discussed our top five Britcoms, and when we did it, Dan was he was on tour,
yeah.
So we did it over Skype, and just the audio on his end just didn't record properly,
yeah.
And I tried to go back and correct it in post, but it just sounded shit,
yeah.
And we just had to jettison the episode. So it'd be pretty cool if we got Josh.
We could do that.
Mock that up and talk about some definitely. Britcoms.
I can move myself a little bit, and we can have a three seat thing. Yeah, we could do that. Easy.
Cool. But thank you for having me. I can't wait to return to Prattle World.
Definitely. So yet again, guys, I'll have to say goodbye to you, my little boar mongers. So where can you find me? So you can find Spider-Man the Secret Boars on Facebook. If you go into the search engine at the top and put at Secret Boars, you will be taken to the Facebook page. On Twitter, it's at Dan_Boars. The podcast is available on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and many, many more. Use the hashtags Join the Prattalion and hashtag Prepare for Prattle. I've been Dan. He's been Dan. Good night.
Good night.